My castaway this week is a novelist and playwright. He was born in Bromley in Kent, the son of an Indian father and an English mother. School didn't interest him, but writing did. And at the age of 19, he had his first play performed at the Royal Court. More plays followed, and by the age of 26, he was a full-time professional writer. "I haven't had a job since," he says. Unless, of course, you count writing My Beautiful Laundrette and The Buddha of Suburbia as doing a job. He enjoys being iconoclastic. Race and sex are dominant themes. But as one critic has said of him, there are few people better placed to write about contemporary Britain. He is Hanif Qureshi. Your major successes, though, Hanif, have in the main been about your past, not so much your present. Laundrette in the 80s, Buddha was set in the 70s. Do you think you're too much part of the establishment these days to go on using your own life as material?
Well, if you're a writer, you don't really have anything else. You can only use what you have around you.
But you've enjoyed being a rebel, being iconoclastic, as I say, haven't you? I remember Newsweek writing, Hanif Qureshi lives to offend. You know, you enjoyed it when the BBC switchboard was jammed, when you said on Start the Week that the poll tax riots were terrific. You know, I mean, that's your style, isn't it? That's been the way it's been.
When I started out, I was surprised by the fact that you could say things and people would write them down, because it had never happened to me before. And after The Laundrette, when people started to listen to me, I was amazed that the people would take what you said seriously, and I enjoyed playing with that.
So what are you going to write about now? Being middle-aged, being a father, going to antenatal clinics? I mean, is that what it's going to be about from now on?
I don't know. It has to surprise me, otherwise it wouldn't be interesting. I write really in order to keep myself alive, to interest myself, to find out what I think. And so when I start, I don't know, and when I get to the end, I'm always disappointed, and then I start again.
Always disappointed? You don't like your own work?
Well, one is disappointed because somehow one has never quite solved the problems one always wants to solve in writing, really, and there are always more problems to solve, which is where you carry on.
OK, let's start with some music on your desert island. Tell me about your first one.
Well, I remember going to see A Hard Day's Night in the Bromley Odeon with my mum and the other boys and their mums, and all the mothers stood up and put their hands over their ears and screamed, and we, being good boys, sat in our chairs. And I was so amazed by this phenomenon and what it was these boys, the Beatles, were doing and why they weren't working in banks, which was what we were supposed to be doing. I suppose, in a sense, they sort of liberated us. They made you think that you could get away from the suburbs in some way, that you could get to London, which was in those days swinging, and lead a life which was quite different to the one that was expected of you and that would be rather like the one those boys were living. I've chosen I Am the Walrus because when I heard the words Semolina Pilchard climbing up the Eiffel Tower, I was so shocked and amazed that anybody would say anything like this in a record that I could see that pop music was moving into all kinds of new areas, which would be terrifically exciting.
I'm crying, Semolina Pilchard.
Beatles and I Am the Walrus. In a sense, Hanif, you've fulfilled your father's dream, haven't you? Because he wanted to be a writer and never made it.
My father spent his whole life working in an embassy in London, but really he wanted to be a writer. And every morning when I would wake up before I would go and do my paper round, he would be downstairs hitting this huge typewriter. And the whole house would kind of reverberate with this banging, this hammering. And he was determined to be a novelist. And he wrote many novels, and he would send them off to publishers, and they would come back with desperate regularity. We then conceived the idea, because they depressed him so much, that we would anticipate the postman and hide them, and we would kind of put them in the garden and in the shed and so on, because it meant so much to him. He wanted to be a writer, and therefore he wanted me to be a writer too, and he thought that was the best job anybody could ever have.
So when it happened for you, how did he react?
He was extremely pleased and, I would imagine, desperately envious at the same time, because it was something that he wanted for himself.
But what, just staying with your childhood for a minute, what kind of books were there in the house? What did he read? What were you brought up on? What were you taught to read?
I was brought up really on two kinds of literature. American literature, which was sort of Kerouac, Salinger, Philip Roth, Bellow and all those writers at that time who were writing about sex and pop music and running away from home and all that stuff. And it was much more lively and brighter than British writing at that time, because you didn't feel like dancing to Iris Murdoch, as it were. And also to Russian literature, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Gogol, because they were so funny and they were so gloomy and they were so violent and they were comic at the same time. So those two streams, I suppose, of writing influenced me or affected me more than any other.
But, I mean, you might, in the age that you were brought up in, during the 60s and the 70s, you might have escaped, you know, found escapism through television or through pop music, as you say. It was your father, was it, who taught you to read, showed you that there was a way through a sort of escapism through reading, through literature?
At that time, it was very difficult for me because South London was really violent and many of my friends had become skinheads, and Enoch Powell was making his speeches. And it was heavy on those streets, and my father was frightened, and I was frightened. And I suppose the idea of being a writer was a way of getting out of South London to another world, and also a way for me to try and understand why I was living in so much abuse and violence, and why I would come home every day covered in spit. And why I would feel as if I'd been beaten up, or why I couldn't go to certain people's houses.
Every day?
Yeah, I was insulted racially every day of my life between the age of 4 and 16. And I suppose writing was a way in which I tried to make sense of it or find a way through it.
What about your mother? Because she was white, as I've said. She must have married your father. I mean, you were born in 54. Presumably she married him in the early 50s. An unusual thing, a brave thing, you might say, for her to have done at that time.
Yes, I would say so, though she never talked about it very much. I think originally Indians in Britain were rather rare and exotic creatures. And then through the 60s and 70s, during the period of immigration, we became the focus of all kinds of other people's violence or preconceptions and so on. And I think she found it very difficult then because she'd married into something that she didn't expect and didn't understand.
So she hadn't anticipated the racism. She wasn't brave in that sense, but suddenly
she had to deal with it, and I think she dealt with it very well, and we seemed to get through it all right. And I think my sister and I, or other people that have been through this kind of stuff, I think it gives you a terrific kind of education in seeing the world from another perspective, which has informed everything that I've done since.
Tell me about record number two.
Well, Miles Davis, I remember I had a girlfriend who lived in Chislehurst, which was rather posh for us. I went round to her house and she was terrifically modern. And she put on this very strange jazz record. And I thought of jazz as being sort of old white men with pot bellies. And I heard this very groovy sound, which was a sort of mixture of rock and jazz, I suppose. And I fell in love with Miles Davis and have listened to one of his records every day of my life ever since.
Miles Davis, in a silent way. You were the only Asian boy at your school, you say, Hanif. But it wasn't simply a case, was it, of you being the abused. You were also part of those boys because you were British, you were Bromley born and bred. That must have been confusing.
Well, I had two families. I had my father's family and all my uncles and cousins who lived in Karachi but would spend a lot of time in London, and who spoke most of the time in Punjabi or in Urdu. I spent most of my childhood amongst people whose language I didn't understand. And the rest of the time I was with, I suppose, lower middle class or working class kids from the estates near where I lived. So this combination of kind of hooliganism and upper class liberal Indianness kind of went off in my head in a rather combustible way, I suppose, yes.
But those boys who were your friends were the boys who became the skinheads, and presumably they expected you, up to a certain point, to go out with them, being hooligans.
Yeah, I was living in the midst of something quite difficult, which was to do with boys who would go out looking for Pakistanis to beat up, who would go out paki-bashing, and they would say to me, are you coming with us tonight, you know? And sometimes they thought of me in that way when it's convenient for them, and other times they didn't. And they would make an exception in my case, but of course it was very complicated because the sort of people who they were beating up were men like my father. So yes, it was very difficult and frightening.
But you've written since that you started to deny your Pakistani self. You said, I was ashamed, it was a curse, I wanted to be rid of it.
I didn't like being the focus of so much violence, particularly from authority, I suppose. Because in those days, the teachers were pretty violent, and I had a teacher who would only call me Pakistani Pete, for instance. And you felt completely humiliated by all this.
But what about the kind of stuff that was on the television at the time? I mean, then would Alf Garnett would have been sounding off, wouldn't he? I mean, we're always told that the argument was that he was so extreme that it was laughable, and that it was making the point, really, that his views were repellent. Is that how it came across to you?
Well, I remember sitting with my family through things like that, and you did feel extremely victimised, mostly because there weren't any other images to counterbalance that kind of stuff. And I suppose one of the things that I try to do is to show other notions of what Asian people might or might not be like.
So you took to writing. How easily did it come?
I was extremely determined, and I've always been very determined and disciplined and kind of ambitious in a sense, because I knew that that was the only way out for me. Otherwise, I was going to be sitting in that semi-detached, working in a bank for the rest of my life, and I was very determined, and I thought, I'm getting out of here. And I would write in the morning before I went to school, and I would write in the afternoon when I got home, and I would sort of rest during the day when I was at school in order to get my creative energies back.
So you didn't pay any attention to schoolwork, but you were actually working very hard at home.
Yes, I hated the boredom of being at school, really. But I loved the fact that, I suppose, our method of communication amongst one another was pop music, and we would spend all day exchanging records and talking to each other about what the Beatles were doing or what the Rolling Stones had been saying and so on. And that was when you learned about culture, really. You learned that culture was something that was a form of exchange between people. And falling in love with pop music was, for me, like falling in love with culture.
Record number three.
Well, if you were on a desert island and you were feeling lonely and depressed and you heard this record by the Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK, which is such a terrible sort of screeching noise and a sort of howl and comes from these sort of dirty little Dickensian street kids, it would remind you about what was so horrible about living in England and what was so wonderful about it too, which is a kind of defiance that this record represents. Now dogs running, anarchy for the UK. It's coming sometime, and maybe I give a wrong time, stop a traffic line. Your future dream is a shopping scheme, cause I wanna be anarchy. Sex Pistols and Anarchy in the UK. You were a student at London University, you got out of Bromley by day, and you sold ice creams and programmes at the Royal Court Theatre by night, but you got started as a writer. Can you describe that moment when, at the age of 19, you saw your first play performed on the stage there? Well, I wrote a play and I sent it to the Royal Court, which was really the only theatre I'd ever heard of, though I'd never seen a play there. And I went in there one afternoon and the man said, oh, we're going to give you a job here and we're going to do your play and we're going to give you a job selling ice creams and you can sell programmes and you can read scripts. And then he took me into the auditorium, and Samuel Beckett was standing on the stage with Billy Whitelaw, and he said, in the afternoons, you come in here, and you sit down there, and you look at this man rehearsing this play. And then I went home after this, and I thought, this is the life, this is what I want. And I was away.
You spent the next 10 years, I think, writing plays, didn't you? And you wrote The King and Me about a girl's obsession with Elvis, and you wrote Borderline and Outskirts, Tomorrow Today and so on. But you've written since that My Beautiful Laundrette was, and I quote, a synthesis and extension of the plays which preceded it. Can you explain that?
The plays I wrote were an attempt in some way for me to try and find what it was that I was about. Did I want to be a serious writer? Did I want to be a comic writer? Did I want to write about race? And how could I do that? Also, at the same time, issues like politics and sexuality, race, leftism, and so on, were discussed in the theatre in a way they probably weren't being discussed on television or in the novel.
But it seemed to me that the way you went about writing about these things was not in that heavy-handed didactic way, but you decided to treat those very serious subjects that you've mentioned with humour. That's the style you developed.
Yes. I realised that I liked laughing and that the world was an amusing place and that I wanted to be, in some sense, a comic writer. And I was on the so-called sort of Maoist hard left at the time. And the theatre was supposed to be some kind of debate about society. And so I did try and write plays that were like that. But at the same time, I kept finding things funny. And that kind of combination seemed to me to be the way forward and kind of manifest itself finally in My Beautiful Laundrette.
But tell me a bit about making the film Laundrette, because it starred a laundrette, beautiful laundrette called Powders, and I can see it now, all the sort of soft blue lights and the leather seats and the canned music. Did you actually build this laundrette to film in?
Well, there was a great friend of my family who saw that I was only writing, and so he used to come round to my house and take me down to his laundrettes, and he would show me these wretched places and say, look, you know, it was the beginning of Thatcherism. And he would say, a boy like you could do really well out of a laundrette, and you should come and work with me and run them. And being smart, I didn't run laundrettes, but I went home and I wrote a story about a bloke running a laundrette, which was how it started.
When you were filming it, did you create it? Did people try to come in and bring their washing in, for example?
No, people in the neighbourhood were really pleased, actually, that a laundrette was opening in their district, and they did actually, come down with their washing, actually, and I could see that you could provide a decent facility for the neighbourhood by doing that.
But undoubtedly, My Beautiful Laundrette was an incredible success. You were nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay. It grossed $15 million, I think, at the box office. You were made, really. Did it transform your life?
We were innocent then. I remember going to Edinburgh with Daniel Day-Lewis and some of the other actors from the film, and suddenly you realise that for the first time in your life that you were at the centre of something and you'd done something that was a hit.
And you were met by stretched limos and heaven knows what, I presume.
Yes, I went in a limousine and I thought, I want everyone from Bromley to see me getting out of this limousine at the Oscars when I got out, you know. And I thought, this is why I've come from Bromley and I want this every day. And it was just fantastic. And you suddenly realise that people liked what you did. It completely changed my life. I had money. People wanted to meet you. You could do whatever you wanted. And it was terrible and distressing and sort of awful because it was so difficult to deal with. And it was wonderful too because you realised that suddenly then that being a writer was for real and that you had done what you'd always wanted to do.
Tell me about record number four.
Well, I've always liked Dylan, like most people did, and I suppose in the 60s he was the central kind of pop figure for all of us. And this record is very harsh and very cruel, and I had a girlfriend who'd always play it when I walked into the room, and I wondered why, and then I listened to the lyrics very carefully and then I understood something.
If I was a master thief, perhaps I'd rob them. Satisfied with your position and your place. Don't you understand? It's not my problem.
Bob Dylan and positively Fourth Street. Pop music is obviously important to you, Hanif, and your latest novel, The Black Album, named after a cult Prince album. It's said to be a novel with a soundtrack, but it's also about a writer and a fatwa. It's about Muslim fundamentalism. Salman Rushdie is a friend of yours, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
How great an influence has he been on you?
He's always been a great example to people like me, and I was very affected in 89 by the fatwa because it made me think about why all these people wanted to kill this bloke for writing a book they didn't like. So I started going to the colleges, to different parts of London, and to the mosques and so on, and talking to young Asian kids about Rushdie. And some of them had very extreme political and social views, which shocked me, being a good liberal boy, very much. And some of that research and that work went into what became The Black Album, which is a book about a book.
But did it shed any light on why such people should want somebody who'd written a book to be dead?
I think it came out of a terrible sense of disillusionment, which I think has probably set in, you know. We came to England in the 50s and 60s with such hope, and most of my father's generation came here to make money and to do well and to start a new life. By the end of the 80s, you could see through the children that the dream had kind of begun to run out. Many of these kids whose fathers had come here to work were unemployed. They were in bad housing. They felt discriminated against. They felt that what they wanted to do in life maybe wouldn't happen. And you could see that that an extreme religion would be rather comforting because it would give you a whole view of the world. It would unite you with other people. Rushdie and his book became a kind of focus for that anger.
So you began to understand where it all comes from. It doesn't make it any more acceptable, does it?
No, I hate all of that stuff, and it's alien to everything that I think and feel, but I tried to write a book which was as sympathetic as possible. And I liked a lot of the kids. I could see that the things they believed were awful, but in some sense that sometimes you can separate what people believe from what they are.
But you don't in the end take sides in the novel, do you? You air the arguments, but you don't conclude anything. Why not, when you feel so strongly that it's so wrong and, you know, you are so close to Salman?
I suppose because I like books which are debates, and you wouldn't want to read something in a sense that the author has sort of made up their mind in advance, because then there wouldn't be anywhere to go.
But if the book was, if you like, a gesture of allegiance to Salman, you can still air all the arguments but make some value judgment at the end. Why didn't you?
Well, there might not be value judgments in that book. I mean, a book is like a person. It moves freely in the world, and you can make up your mind about it as you wish, and it's for you to decide.
Next piece of music.
Next piece is a record by Massive Attack called Unfinished Sympathy. And Massive Attack are a Bristol group, and one of the reasons, it seems to me, for living in England is the fact that the young people who live here continue to make music, which is always interesting and alive. And this record is a combination, I suppose, of all kinds of strange Indian, Afro-Caribbean and English elements mixed up together, which make for a fantastic combination of new music.
Massive Attack and Unfinished Sympathy. You eventually went to Pakistan, Hanif Qureshi, in the early 80s. You went to Karachi to visit your relatives. That was the first time. You'd have been nearly 30. It was the first time you'd been to Asia. Was it exciting? How did it strike you?
Well, I wanted to find my roots, as it were. And so I went off to stay with my family in Karachi for the first time. And this was during the period of so-called Islamization in Pakistan, which was also known as the Great Leap Backwards, which is when I first became interested in all this stuff. And I remember feeling very much at home because of my family and everything I was learning about them, and also feeling completely alien there as well. And one of my uncles rather kindly turned around and said to me, "The thing about you is," he said, "you'll always be a Paki, and we're Pakistanis. They belong there and I didn't." And I think being in Pakistan made me think about what I liked about being in England and how English I felt. And I was kind of swinging around Karachi feeling like a sort of Englishman abroad, actually.
So you learned that you were truly British, did you?
I learned that I was British in a sense and not Pakistani in another sense. And I learned that in a sense you couldn't be at home anywhere. And then I thought, well, why do you have to be at home anywhere? And then I realised that all that was a myth and that you could be free.
But when you came back to this country, how was it then? I mean, presumably it was a kind of culture shock in reverse.
Yes, it was a terrible culture shock because all that Thatcherite stuff was starting to happen too, which I found, which was terribly ruthless and seemed very cruel to me. But by then I had written My Beautiful Laundrette, which was my sort of ticket into the future. And so things started to change rather quickly at that time.
What's your view, though, of Britain today? Are we less racist than we were, in your view?
I do think that Britain is a deeply racist society, and I do think there's a lot of discrimination and prejudice against all kinds of people from different backgrounds and different cultures. And I think the relation between races or the relation between cultures is probably the central issue of our time, certainly in the United States and probably in Europe too. And it's something that we need to do a good deal more thinking about.
But it's not something that you suffer anymore because you move in these liberated, tolerant circles, presumably.
Yes, I've kind of got out of all that, in a sense, because I make my own work. It's an enormous privilege, you know. I get up in the morning and I think, what am I going to do today that will entertain me, that will make me feel alive, which is writing. But there aren't many people who are able to do that, and their circumstances are much more difficult than mine, which is privileged.
What's the future then for your little boys? How old are they, your twins?
My two boys, Sachin and Carlo, are 2.5. And I hope they're going to grow up in a much more mixed and tolerant world than the one that I did.
Record number 6.
When I was at school, David Bowie, who had been at school 10 years before me, was our hero. And there was a picture of him in the hall, which we would sort of genuflect before. And when the BBC made the series of The Bird of Suburbia, Bowie did the music, and Roger Michell, the director, and I went to Switzerland and worked with him. And it was a great sort of honour and privilege to be working with this man who I'd worshipped for so long. And he wrote a record called The Bitter of Suburbia.
David Bowie and Buddha of Suburbia, the novel which you published in 1990, and it won the Whitbread Prize and became a BBC four-parter. Very much the story we've been talking about, really, your story, your life, Indian father, white mother, suburbia, racism, sex, escape to London, experimental theatre, it was all there, really. Why did it take you so long to get to the novel form?
Well, I started off wanting to write novels, and then I wrote plays, and then I wrote films, and then finally, after My Beautiful Laundrette and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, then I had some money, so then I could take 2 years to write this book. And I remember sitting on a balcony in Madras in India, where my father was born, in fact, thinking, there's all this material about the 70s, which I haven't used before. And then I suddenly thought, oh, well, but there's a whole book here. It's not just a film. There's tons of stuff ready to go. And obviously enough time had passed, but I could still remember it all. I wasn't that far away from it. And it sort of came to me complete. And writing that book was terrific fun, you know. I just had to sort of, it just flowed out of me. It was all there.
More satisfying than writing for the theatre?
It's satisfying in a different way, you know. I like doing films and I like doing plays because you get to work with other people. And those collaborations produce combinations of work that you couldn't do on your own.
But for the writing itself?
I suppose writing a novel really is about the language. It's about the words that you use. And there isn't anybody else there to interpret them. It's just you and the reader in this kind of particular kind of distinct privacy. You, as it were, feel that you're going right into somebody else's mind if they want you to. And so writing that novel was a great pleasure to me.
You've also taught writing in your time, although you've confessed that it's, quote, a bit of a racket mainly for the benefit of the teacher. Does that mean, what does it mean? It means you can't teach writing because it comes from somewhere that you can't define.
Well, I've been very helped and encouraged by other people. But it is a bit of a racket, yeah, I can see that, because you can't give other people talent and you can't give other people discipline. And in the end, those are the two things that make people into writers or any kind of artists, you know, which is a kind of determination. Lots of people have talent, actually, and lots of people have good ideas, but the ability to sit at a desk with the door closed for hours and hours on end is quite a difficult one, which I think maybe perhaps being stranded on a desert island would be very good for people who wanted to be artists.
Record number 7.
This is a record by a kind of new, young, black Bristol guy called Tricky. And the music he's making seems to me to be very original and strange and dark and just right for our time.
I stare firm for a soil. Look a rock or falls. And they juice, juice, juice. Dress me up in stitsy. Hell is round the corner where I shelter. Is something a schism? Living out of style.
Tricky and Hell is Round the Corner. So to a desert island, Hanif, what will you miss most, people apart?
Well, I do like other people, actually, and as I got older, one of the great pleasures of my life really is being with other people. But I'm used to being on my own, which is what I do most of the day, so I think I could deal with that.
But you'll get bored.
I would get bored because I like distraction. And when I'm writing, actually, I do listen to music all day, so I get through a lot.
This kind of music, or pop music?
Mostly pop music, and usually rather loud, and people come in and they can't believe that I'm listening to this terrible noise and can concentrate. But in fact, the silence makes me nervous, so I think having these records on a desert island will do me good.
And would you want to write on a desert island if there was not going to be anybody there to read it?
Well, I would, I think, miss that connection, because you start off writing for nobody, or you don't know whether there's anybody else out there. And then when you start, you realise that people do take some interest in what you do, and you do need them, as it were, to make your work come alive. So, yeah, I would miss that, but I could put it in a bottle and chuck it into the sea.
You're now on kind of syllabuses and things, and students presumably write to you with deep analyses of what you've written. What do you make of those?
Yes, I go to some trouble to make my work light and accessible, and I can see that they go to some trouble to make my work indigestible. So I do find that rather confusing.
What, you don't understand their criticisms?
I often can't get through the language, no.
If you could, let me ask you an extra Desert Island question here. If you could take one of your own pieces of writing with you, I wonder which one you'd choose. Which one are you most at peace with, I suppose?
Oh, God, it's very hard to say, because there are bits in all of the things that you do that you are proud of and you think, oh, that works, that does what it's supposed to do. And there are other bits that obviously don't work at all. But only you know that, you know, and maybe for other people they wouldn't notice that at all. So I would have to take different bits stuck together, as it were.
Tell me about your last record.
Well, English pop music seems to continually renew itself, and there's always something fresh happening. And Oasis seem to me to have all the right combinations for English pop, which is what they write very good pop songs. They're suitably defiant. And this is a terrifically lively record called It's Good to Be Free. There is no time. The little things that make me so happy. All I wanna do is live by the sea. The little things that make me so happy. But it's good. Yes, it's good. It's good to be free.
Oasis and It's Good to Be Free. If you could only take one of those eight records, Henny, which one would it be?
Well, I think Miles Davis, along with Picasso and Stravinsky, is probably one of the, you know, great artists of the century. And what he's done in music, the range of his music from the beginning right through to the end, is such an extraordinary and unique achievement. And I'll have to take In a Silent Way by Miles Davis.
And what about your book?
I thought I would take something by Sigmund Freud, because he seems to me to be the sort of presiding genius of our violent and dangerous century. And his work in the area of the unconscious is such a brilliant discovery that illuminates our time like nothing else. And also because his work is full of stories. Those case studies are like short stories or little novels.
And your luxury?
Well, I like relaxing when I get home, and I thought I would take some marijuana seeds, which I would grow on my island and water regularly, though I'm not a keen gardener. I think in this particular environment they would probably grow very well. And then after a time I would cultivate them and smoke them. And presumably, as I would be in charge of the law on the island, I wouldn't have to arrest myself for doing this, as I might have to in London.
Hanif Qureshi, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much.